Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AT2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this, the Limar Technical Net. The Limar Technical Net has been going strong for over 42 years, mostly under the care of Dick, K2RIW, who became a silent P almost 3 years ago. And in his memory, we continue it, hopefully sharing knowledge with each other, learning from each other, teaching each other, and entertaining each other a bit. If you're getting upset with something that you hear on the technical net, then you're doing it wrong. The idea is, again, to learn, to teach, and to be a bit entertained, hopefully. With that in mind, let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual link. Okay, if you want to reach me, and you can't do it by the radio, then email is as good as any method. That would be either for what we used to call mailbag questions, questions that you wouldn't be available at your radio transmit during the technical net, and you'd like them submitted, and you'd either listen to the audio feed, which we'll discuss a little later, or the archive files of the audio of the technical net. So that's what we used to call mailbag. It was very popular in its time. Also, if you have a topic for discussion, now that could be a topic that you would like to teach us all about, if you're knowledgeable about, or it could be a subject you have some knowledge and you would like to enter into a conversation with a number of people here on the technical net, or it could be simply that you don't know much about it and you would like to hear about it and you prefer just sitting back and listening to other people talk about the subject. So that's topic. Also, we are always in search of what I call puzzles. Technical puzzles, preferably amateur radio related, but some science, technology, to kind of stretch our brains a little bit and exercise our logic circuits internally. As I mentioned repeatedly, I would prefer questions and puzzles that can't be Googled the answer in 10 seconds, because that takes a little bit of the fun out of things. So, you know, there are surprisingly puzzles I found where either the answer is not available on a fresh Google search, or even better, they give you the wrong answer. So those are fine. Also, if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him some to take a look at something you saw, space or NASA related, you can email me. Now, you can email Paul directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But again, if you'd like to email me, one of my email addresses is mailbag@at2gs.com. Again, mailbag@at2gs.com. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. I always provide a link page of interesting YouTube and articles that I've seen over the last week. I do that every week, and I leave them on the web pages, and you can review them at your heart's content or not at all. They'll be there whether you look or not. You get to it by just typing into your browser, roy.at2gs.com. We have a fresh new page for 2023, but you can get that to the 2022 and the 2021 pages, and even going back, I think, to about 2018 or so. Anyway, that's at roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's quiet, sometimes it's noisy. You get there by typing into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. We have an audio stream. I initially provided an audio stream of the technical net for the 3 hours that we're on, but some people asked if I could just leave the switch on, and they listen to Glen Oaks throughout the week when they're not able to listen through the radio. So you can get there by typing into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. Of course, I like to remind people regularly, Mike, KT2NJI, has an archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has over 1 million visitors, and it has stored archives of this technical net that go as far back as December of 2006. So take a look at it, or play a few of them. They're the concentrated wisdom of hams that have unfortunately either moved away from the area or have become silent keys. But their wisdom remains in those files. So check it out. Okay, let me drop one more time and then I'll come back. Okay. Well, as per usual, I will ask people if they have any technical questions or comments or statements. Preferably, the first few would be good if it was amateur radio related, but as time goes on, we open this topic to every aspect of science and technology. I have a few small little puzzlers in my back pocket. I didn't have an opportunity to use them in the last few technical nets. I might pass this week. It depends on whether we have a lot of free time, and I feel that audience participation is in the mood for it. So that's the plan for tonight, and of course, 10:15, Paul will come back again for the SpaceNet report. And before we begin, really, I want to wish everyone a happy, healthy New Year. So far, 2023 is looking reasonably well to me, and I hope it's looking reasonably well to all of you. So, with all that in mind, if anyone has any questions, comments, or statements for tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
W2 Baker Sands Moore.
Ken, I have an electronics, but not ham radio question.
Okay, Rich and Ken simultaneously recognized. With the beauty of duplexing links, we're able to accomplish that. So I have you both down. Rich is first, Ken second. Anyone else want to put their name down for tonight for any questions or statements or comments or topics or what have you?
AD2VHD.
Okay, Jim, I have you in the number three position. Anyone want to grab the fourth position?
And to AVCN, if you feel like, if you have a time, you can go to American Achievement of Fusion Experiment a little bit deeper, and some other subjects that you can do, you send me the email that you are interested with.
Okay, Wes, you're in the number four slot. Anyone want to call for the number five slot? Okay, hopefully as time goes on, there'll be a few additional people coming on or someone sitting around will think up a question. Okay, so the first person on the list for tonight is Rich, W2BZ. What is your question or topic or comment tonight, Rich?
Okay, Happy New Year to everybody. As you know, Roy, I've gotten the bug again for HF, like I was 16 years old again. It's just gripped me hard. The problem is, not only am I in an HOA, I'm in a very, very limited geographical spot here, which tremendously limits my choice of antennas. I put up a inverted V for 20 meters, and I've been making contacts on 20 meters with like 5-7 reports, blah, blah, blah. But I want to get on 40. I want to get on 40. So I've done a tremendous amount of research, and I've come up with the concept of an antenna, which is an N-fed half-wave long-wire antenna. But I have to shorten that. So I have to come up with a shortened N-fed half-wave antenna, which means I have to get into coils. Let me let it drop. Okay, so to wind my own coils, loading coils, I an inductor, capacitance, and resistive meter, which I haven't received yet. It's on the way. But my question is, if I start winding a coil, let's say around a little piece of PVC, how can I take readings as I you know, let's say I wind 10 winds around the PBC, I want to see what the inductance is. I have to get to 34 microhenries. So I wind it, I want to take a reading, but how can I take a reading if the rest of the reel of the wire is still attached to the end of, to the right side of the coil that I'm winding, if you know what I mean? Won't that get in the way of a correct reading? Do you understand what I'm talking about? Go ahead.
Yes, I do, Rich. Well, I mean, as far as I'm aware, and I would love to hear if other people have better ideas than me. You kind of have to take it from either one direction or another. If you're willing to violate the dielectric material on the wire, you can tap it at different points and use that as an indication of the number of coils and measure the inductance by kind of piercing whatever insulation it has. The flip side is to overwind it, measure it, and then cut portions of it away bit by bit until you land at the inductance that you're interested in. That's kind of the only two ways I can see it, either as an additive or a subtractive method. But again, if anyone else has any cleverer ideas, feel free.
I won't even know what overwinding is. In one design, the guy says 90 winds around a certain diameter will get to 34 microhenries. But I want to try for a larger diameter so I don't have to make as many winds. And I was just wondering, even if I tapped it without the spool of wire cut off, won't that spool of wire impinge upon a correct reading, even if I tapped it at certain points? If I scraped away the insulation and tapped it, I still have the spool of wire attached to the right-hand side. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, it might change it ever so slightly, but tapping an inductor is a very well-used method. A lot of antenna tuners tap an inductor in order to adjust its inductance. There are MFJ kind of crappy antennas that you put on your windowsill that have a tapped inductor coil, which effectively does the same thing. So will it kind of shift the inductance a little bit? Probably. Will it do it significantly? I don't think so.
That brings up another question. If this design says 34 microhenries, how critical is that? I mean, are you okay with 40 microhenries? Are you okay with only 35 microhenries, you know, 10% away from what the design calls for? I've never really played around with inductance, so I don't know how critical it is.
Well, to a degree, it's going to be important. If you're off by 10%, it means that the resonant frequency will be off by 10%. Most likely. I'd have to take a look at the mathematics, but does it have to be incredibly precise? No, it doesn't have to be incredibly precise, but it has to be close. And there are ways of kind of tweaking and adjusting it by spreading an inductor out or squeezing them together, or playing around with other physical aspects of the inductor. You can slightly tweak the inductance to a degree. I don't know. It strikes me, unfortunately, your history with antennas lately, this is going to be a very complicated situation. This is not a simple antenna to build, as I think you think it is, you know, where you just wind something 90 times and you just put it up and it works. So, be prepared to have to do some tweaking with it.
The The other problem is the wire that I'm using, the magnetic wire that I'm using, is very thin wire. It's 20-gauge wire, so it's going to be sort of hard to tap, you know, like three quarters of the way into a coil. It's going to be a little hard to spread it apart and solder a lead three quarters of the way because of how thin the wire is.
Comment.
Yes, John.
Comment, K2GJE.
Oh, sorry, Ed. Yeah, please, comment.
Thank you. There are formulas without even using an inductance meter. They used to give it to you in the amateur radio's handbook, but I'm sure it's on the internet someplace. Knowing the diameter, knowing the number of turns, knowing the length, you can calculate the inductance of that coil. Over.
I always got the impression that on the internet, physical aspects can expect a little adjustment, I just, in wiggle room, wanted to get, you know, as physical as that can, you know, do have a meter that looks calculated as possible, and wound, because those different calculators, you know, they're even adding the thickness of the wire to the diameter of the core, you know, as something that you have to take into consideration. So it just seems that if I wrap this, you know, it'd be nice to have a meter where you wrap it, and let's say it says 20 microhenries, and you wrap another 10 turns, and it says 27 microhenries, and then another 10 turns says 35 microhenries, so you unwrap a couple, and then you get a reading of 34 microhenries, which is right on. It seems like an easy way to know that you're right on with it. I'm also wondering if the coil part of it so outweighs, in a sort of speak, so outweighs having more wire at the end of the coil that it doesn't make all that difference, and I can get a reading at the end of the coil I'm wrapping, even though the reel of wire is still attached.
Okay, I also want to point out that we have John KD2BD that listens to our stream and communicates via the chat room, and he had a couple of comments. He said the ARRL used to sell a slide rule that could predict the inductance of a coil provided its physical dimensions. He doesn't know if they still do it. I don't think they still do it. I haven't seen the ARRL sell any kind of a slide rule in a long time. He also points out that inductance is a property to the square of the number of turns.
Okay, like I said, there are calculators for number of turns, diameter, and all that. I know that. I can calculate with different diameters how many turns that I need. You know, for obvious reasons, I'd like to have a larger diameter and have to wrap a fewer amount of turns. Right now, what's called for in this one design is 90 turns. That's a lot of turns to, you know, to get correct, 90 turns. I'd rather have a 3-inch diameter, a 3-inch core, and have to wrap, you know, only 50 turns, for argument's sake. So I guess what I'll have to do from what I'm hearing, or not hearing from you guys, is, you know, wrap, cut off the reel of wires, and then take a reading. Is that about what you're saying, Roy?
Okay, someone basically just said, I don't know what to interpret that as. If anyone has an opinion on it, please.
Move.
Okay. I guess we're approaching this with humor. I think again the subtractive method is the best way to go. So I would just overwind it and then cut it back. And, you know, again, you know, I'm not sure even if your inductance meter is going to be incredibly accurate either, but, you know, there's always a little fudge space to work with.
Okay, well, that's what I'm going to have to do then. I'm going to have to try to reduce the windings by increasing the diameter and then overwind, cut off the rest of the wire, and take my reading.
Okay, I wish you good luck. Theoretically, you should be able to tell when you've approached something close to an effective half-wave end set when the impedance at the resonant frequency without the 49-to-1 balance goes to a kind of maximum of 2 or 3,000 ohms.
Yeah, I could do that too. I also have to... besides the 49-to-1, I have to create an RF choke sort of near the rig using a toroid and winding it with the balance with the coax that I'm using to feed the rig. So I have to put that in the circuit also. That's pretty mandatory for this type of antenna. I wouldn't need any of this if I could put up a full wave, half wave end fed. I mean, a full half wave end fed. I wouldn't need any coils, but I'm thinking even if I want to do an inverted V with coils on both sides, I'm going to have to learn how to wind coils and get them pretty close to the inductance that's called for. For an inverted, for a dipole, the inductance is 110 microhenries on each side of the dipole, or an inverted V, and that would require a one-to-one balance. Anyway, I think I know what I have to do now. I'll report back. I'd like to see how much the reading will change when I cut off the rest of the wire, compared to leaving it on and taking a reading at a point as if it were off on the lead. But that's all. Thanks, Roy. And how does my signal sound with the radials off?
Yeah, AC2GS, by the way. It sounds surprisingly good. As I mentioned, that in the absence of a counterpoise that's designed for the antenna, your antenna is most likely using your transmission line as the counterpoise. So the seesaw is working. It may not be working in quite the same way that it does when the radials are connected, but you're getting out, and we all hear you, and there's full quiet. So it's good.
All right. So thanks, everybody, for your help.
Okay. I just want to add a whole bunch of little cautions. Usually, I think when people investigate NFED half waves, they don't see, length shortening, loaded coils, and they're designed for a bunch of different reasons. The small reasons are, in the case of all loaded shortened antennas, you're decreasing the radiation resistance, which means that any kind of insertion loss has a greater effect on the efficiency. You're increasing the Q, which is going to cause the bandwidth to be more narrow and require more use of an antenna tuner to get it past a certain point. Another thing is, with half-wave end sets, a lot of people try and use their harmonics. If you ever see the design of a well-designed end-fed half-wave, they usually have either a very small inductor or a very small capacitor that tweaks the harmonics to better align with the amateur radio band. Having a massive loading coil is going to disrupt the harmonics out of the ham band. So it may work perfectly fine for a 40, but if you try to use it, as many people do, for other harmonics, they'll be completely off the ham band. But I wish you luck, Rich. I hope it works for you. And please come back and tell me all the details.
You know, one thing I'm going to try, the full 66 feet of wire, but not in a straight line. You know what I mean? They say you don't have to have it in a straight line. You could zigzag it. So if I can zigzag a piece of 66 feet of wire back and forth and then go into the 49-to-1, and yeah, the capacitor across the ballon is a 100 picofarad capacitor that people use. But if I could zigzag the wire going back and forth and not have to deal with this coil, and yes, the bandwidth narrows significantly when you include a coil. We'll see what happens. This is the hobby, you know. It's this experimentation that makes this hobby great. W2BZ, back to net.
Okay, very good. By the way, John KD2BD also mentioned that a capacitive hat is a kind of a preferable means to extend a shortened antenna because of the way a capacitive hat works. It does not diminish the radiation resistance, so it doesn't increase the inefficiencies of insertion losses like a loading coil does. So thanks again, John. The problem, though, with capacitive hats is they take up a lot of space. So whereas it's very easy to almost hide a loading coil, putting a capacitive hat at the edge of your antenna element is kind of like screaming in the night. You know, people will kind of look at it. It looks a little odd in the first place. So it's not a good stealth maneuver that loading coils might be. There's a whole bunch of different ways. I would agree with you that it is preferable to try a full-length half-wave handset. When you say zigzag, you know, that could mean anything. I would not zigzag it so that it's basically like a spring compressed. You can have it going off at odd angles here and there. I wouldn't put the portions of the element very close to other portions of the same element, because that's going to couple and give you problems. So you can have it twist and turn, but I wouldn't have it return on itself too much.
Unfortunately, if I do that, it would have to, within a foot or so, have to return on itself a couple of times. So we'll see. Onward and upward. This is the last time I put up a wire antenna for HF. It was a full loop, full wave loop on 80 meters, something like 200 and some odd feet or something up there, when I had a house with a big backyard. And that was an amazing antenna. I couldn't even put up a tenth of that now. So we'll see what happens. W2BZ.
Okay, very good, Rich. As always, I wish you luck. John also added that I don't think he knew exactly, but you do have a nano BNA, and he suggested, of course, that you know you could just sweep your antenna and find the resonance and adjust the coil as necessary. You know, it's not quite the easiest thing. It depends upon how the antenna is deployed and such, and how easy it is to shorten or lengthen the coil accordingly. But yeah, that's an option as well, John. So thank you for that as well. Anyone else with any comments on this particular subject before we move on? Okay. Now we'll move on to Ken, WB2KWC. What's your question for tonight, Ken?
Okay. Good evening, Ryan. Happy New Year. I have a problem with a haunted television. I've got a Vizio television in my bedroom, and occasionally, sometimes a few times a day, I will find it turned on. So I go and I turn it off. And a few hours later, it might be on again. So I'm wondering, what is the problem? What I have done to diagnose it so far is I've taken the remotes and taken them out of the room, figuring, okay, something is accidentally hitting the remote or accidentally, I don't know, pressing on it, or the remote itself is actually firing. That seems to have no effect. I've also disabled something in the television configuration called CEC, which is Consumer Electronic Control, and it's essentially to allow remotes or other piece of equipment to speak a common language to a television and control it. That has not made a difference. I have disabled CEC. So I'm wondering, has anyone else come across this, and what have you done to diagnose it or treat it, and has it been successful? AC2GS, WB2KW6.
Okay, very good, Ted. You brought this up a while ago. We talked about it then. As you mentioned, the two big possibilities was that the remote control was getting erratic in its old age and sputtering IR signals. That's why you took the remotes out. And also, CEC is a means to, through the wire connection of your HDMI video connectors, they channel remote control signals to the television set. So, in other words, with CEC enabled, your receiver's codes for muting and other such things would be shuttled over to the television. So, disabling that was a good thing. My little suggestion would tend to be, just as an experiment, unplug anything other than the power source of the television, and if you have a good idea where the infrared detector is, cover it up with electrical tape. If it still goes on, it means there's a problem with the remote sensing inside the TV set itself. There are other ways that the infrared detector could malfunction. If you've ever noticed that if you have infrared detectors any place, doing things that have nothing to do with shooting a remote at it will cause them to light up. If you take a piece of scotch tape and stick it together and then quickly peel it apart, it will emit a lot of infrared energy and the detectors will go off. So sometimes if the detector in the television is flaky and it's not really doing a strict decoding of the signal, it might misinterpret things. So, firstly, my next move would be isolate it electronically, except of course for the power cable, and then cover the sensor itself up with black tape. And then the only thing it could be doing is an internal circuit error inside the TV set. But if anyone else out there has any clever ideas, feel free.
Yeah, W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
Ken, I've experienced that a couple of times myself. I have a TCL TV, and I think only once or twice that's happened when I've walked into my bedroom and the TV is on. But what does happen a lot more than that is I have a ring of LCD, LED lights on the back of my TV to light up the backspace of the TV to separate it from the wall. And sometimes those just turn on by themselves when the TV is off. So I think it's something that's so esoteric, you know, within the circuitry, the on-off circuitry of the TV, that that it's almost unsolvable unless it's happening all of a sudden and more frequently. That's one thing. But if it's been happening from time to... How often, that's the question, how often does this occur? And if it occurs a lot, you know, that's time to get on the phone with Physio. But Roy's suggestion of covering up the infrared little eye on the front of the TV will tell you if it's anything like that, but I doubt it. I think it's some voltage change in the standby voltage of the TV. At least with mine it is.
At this point it's starting to sound a lot like it's an internal electronic failure of the television set itself. I don't know if the manufacturer, how far it's out of warranty, whether they're going to be incredibly helpful, but it's looking more to be an internal television-based problem.
Okay. I thank you. And, Roy, you have an excellent memory. I had mentioned it before, and I just didn't recall if I had told you about all the things that I had tried to do to fix the problem. Okay, covering up the... I don't recall if you had suggested covering up the IR sensor. I'll get the letters out straight. It's a new year. I'm just learning the alphabet all over again. And I will try that. I will also unplug everything. The only other thing connected to it besides power is the connection from the TiVo, the HDMI connection. So I'll yank that out. And much to my wife's chagrin, she'll have to plug it in each time she wants to use it. But, okay, I will do those things and report back if I have a solution. AC2GS, WB2KW3.
Okay, very good. I wish you luck. And if you find that the situation stops, because, again, just because you disabled the CEC in software doesn't necessarily mean that your television did that. It just sort of flipped the display that it's meant to do that but didn't do that. So, you know, if you find that the phantom turning on goes away, then I would then suggest that you then simply plug in that HDMI. And if it suddenly reoccurs, then there's something funny going on between the two of them where it's passing some signal that it might be interpreting as an on control. If, as Rich suggested, that it may just be a power fluctuation and an internal problem in the television, having the HDMI plugged in or not wouldn't have any effect one way or the other. So it'll be an interesting way to kind of, you might solve the problem, but the solution to the problem probably wouldn't get any cheaper, but still, it's always good to know why things do the things they do.
Yes, that is true. One question, I guess. HDMI cable, it goes into the TV. Do you think it would be a problem if instead of unplugging it at the TV end, if I unplugged it at the TiVo end, which is much easier to get to than... crawling around behind the, well, I shouldn't say crawling around, but, you know, putting my hand behind the TV and trying to find that. The TiVo is in the light. I can find that and unplug it at that end.
You probably would get away with that. The only possible error mode where it would be confusing is if the HDMI cable is not really as isolated as it should be, and it's picking up random RF from your environment, and so having a length of cable feeding into the back of the TV set might be one of the modes that are triggering the power on. So, yeah, in a perfect setup, I would probably go the extra mile of disconnecting it at the TV set. But you can try the other way around, and if you get suspicious results, you might want to try it, you know, with the cable removed from the TV set as a kind of a plan B operation.
Okay, that sounds good. Basically, if unplugging it from the TiVo fixes it, then I've found the problem the easy way. If it doesn't fix it, then I've got to unplug it from the TV. Okay, thank you for your advice.
Chuck, I wish you luck, Ted, and please come back and tell us what the solution to this particular puzzle was.
West to end.
Yes, Paul.
If Ken has composite cables connections on the TiVo, I know the Vizio, well, my Vizio has it. I'm able to use composite instead of the HDMI connection. I mean, the picture's the same, the sound is the same. You know, you put two audio, and then, you know, three cables. Instead of the HDMI, with mine, if I wanted to record something by having the HDMI plugged in, it wouldn't allow me to do that. Some kind of a setting is on the Vizio TV. Maybe something's going on with that, but you can eliminate that by using composite cables. And if you don't have the cables, you can actually go to Cablevision. I went to Cablevision. They gave me the cables, cables for it. You know, took them home, plugged them in. So they're pretty good like that if you have Cablevision. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay. Thanks, Paul. There's a couple little problems I see with that. Composite was very popular back in the VCR days. It doesn't have the bit stream that HDMI has. So you'll probably get a lower resolution analog signal. Matter of fact, that's the reason why you can't copy an HDMI signal is because it's a digital signal and it has an anti-pirating flag set on the digital stream that all the recorders know to disable a recording when it sees it. But if you use a less superior analog signal that's composited, then it doesn't have any digital flags or anything, so it'll let you record it without worrying about piracy issues.
As it may, you know, I'm sure that's true. But temporarily, anyway, you could have that set up like that, and then the problem goes away. You definitely know it has some kind of a problem with the connecting the TiVo with the HDMI. You know, it would eliminate that problem, but know that, well, it has to do with the HDMI connection. Back to you.
Yeah, that would provide that additional information as well. So you have two different ways of doing it. I got the sense that the way Ken was planning to do it was, you know, plugging it in, watching the television, and then when he's done, he's turning it off. In addition to turning it off, he's unplugging the HDMI. So he doesn't seem to be worried about, a video signal. The TV set will be off for all those times. So, you know, either one will get around the CIC feature, not a flaw of controlling the power on your television set.
Okay, I will give it a try, report back, and I think what Paul was referring to is HDC, the High Definition Digital Copy Protection. I've looked at that, but I'll give it a try.
Yeah, it's basically all in digital. It uses bit flags and such. And if you run it through an analog signal that has no bit stream, it doesn't know that it's copyright protected. So that's why some video signals can be copied, others can't, because they're either modified or degraded into analog signals. Anyway, wish you good luck with this one, Ken. I hope we solve it this time. Next on my list for tonight is Jim, KD2VHZ. What's your topic, question, comment for tonight, Jim?
Good evening, Webb, and all this. Tonight I got a question about internet-connected repeaters. I just want to bring this up for quite some time now, but I've had the itch to put it in, and I'll throw it in there tonight. I'll throw it in a phrase. Is the web an accessory of ham radio, or is ham radio an accessory of the web? I don't know the answer to the question. I'm throwing it out there for people to think about. But my history in electronics goes back quite some time, where I was involved with the old Databus 1553 Databus equipment and military aircraft, where it was a dual redundant system. So I learned early on in electronics before I failed in electronics, which I did. No rocket science. But the systems that I learned about were such that one system failed, another took over. I learned to respect that ideology. I'm going to let it drop for a minute and I'll continue. So I'm questioning the move towards internet-connected computers. The internet is a strange place. We all have our opinions on it, but the fact that it is not what we traditionally think of as far as ham radio, where we control the circumstances other than nature controlling what the radio waves are doing, point to point or repeater to repeater, we control the situation. Once you enter a web, the control changes completely, and regardless of what you feel or who you are or what it is, I think inherently connecting with the internet by repeaters I don't think it's a good idea. I want to throw the idea out. Should we be doing this? Is it consistent with the concepts of ham radio, or is it a mistake? So it's a food for conversation. KD2VHD, I'll turn it over to you, Roy.
Okay, this is AC2GX. Well, I think the first thing you have to do is take a hard look at our hobby and try and figure out what it is fundamentally. Most likely you'll get a bunch of different answers from a bunch of different people. Some would say it's all about radio waves. Some would say it's all about physics. But others would say it's all about communication. And there's a significant portion of people who are primarily into the hobby, as I see them, because of communication. And it's that definition of amateur radio where connecting it to voice over internet protocols makes some sense, because it doesn't necessarily have to be entirely made out of an RF stream. From transmitter to receiver, like the good old days. It can have intermediates where it's rerouted and sent far, far farther, more reliably than radio waves can have it. Let me drop for a sec. Now, this is not a novel approach. If you go back, EchoLink, we have people on EchoLink tonight. Hello, people on EchoLink. That's a voice over internet protocol. It's primarily designed for individual users to access both local RF repeaters and non-local RF repeaters using a voice over internet protocol. There is IRLP, which is more designed for linking individual repeaters that have different owners. So it's not really meant primarily as a linking device for, you know, a club that has three repeaters, like we have Selden and we have Glen Oaks, and how do you put it together? IRLP usually isn't a common solution. Those are more meant for linking. We have an Ontario-based repeater that links with us from 8:30 to about 10:30 every Sunday night. I guess they like to listen to a portion of our stream. So that's voice over internet protocol. Then Air America. That's another voice over internet protocol linking. That's a little bit like EchoLink in some ways, and a little bit like IRLP in other ways. So you've had these voice over internet protocols for over 20 years. and they're just getting stronger because they're very, very useful and they're very, very reliable. In case the internet goes to bluey, is everyone in trouble? Well, I think everyone is already in trouble, so I think a little bit more trouble is not really that fundamentally different. But if you want to be a strict person and a gatekeeper and say this is amateur radio and that isn't, yeah, you can do that. It doesn't really accomplish much because the guys who want to do it will still do it, and the guys who don't want to do it will still not do it. But, you know, we can discuss it.
Well said. I respect that response. I think it's interesting that I suppose I come from the question from the old in my career perspective of ham radio always seemed like a dual redundant system. It was isolated. It was air gapped. It was separated and worked independently. And a lot to be said for that. Interested to hear some commentary on that.
Okay, I will open it up to the rest of the people listening and hopefully participating. I think that it was not designed that way. I think it was simply came on that way. Amateur radio, unfortunately, as much as we love it, is kind of the redheaded stepchild of the FCC and of professional broadcasters. It's messy and it's inconvenient for them, and they tolerate us because we don't leave too much of a mess behind. But if the FCC could just kind of get rid of every kind of regulatory aspect of amateur radio overnight, I think they unfortunately jump at it. So emergency services have always kind of held amateurs a little bit away. There are some very well-run amateur emergency services, but there are also some terribly run emergency services, and it's difficult to know which is good and which is bad until you see them in action. So, again, I don't think it was designed that way. I think, unfortunately, that's the lot we were left with. And so I understand, again, and it's always a good idea to bulletproof our methods as well. It would be nice if we, in addition to having a voice over internet protocol link, had kind of a backup RF link, you know, just the same as we have a generator and batteries and other things, it's a power fail. But I think that's up to the individual people who manage our repeaters to kind of think in terms of how much they're willing to invest in a bulletproof system.
Agreed completely. Hoping for some other interjection. Thank you.
Okay. I don't want this to be a monologue. I never want this to be a monologue. I want this to be a dialogue and whatever is more than a dialogue. So if there's anyone out there with any opinions that they'd like to share, please feel free.
WD2KWC?
Yes, Jeff.
Okay, one of the things that I really love about amateur radio is that it can be so many different things. If you want to only operate AM instead of single sideband, well, fine, do it. If you only want to operate CW instead of voice, that's your privilege also. If you want to route some of your traffic over the internet or over a network, that's perfectly acceptable. As far as I'm concerned, do your thing. It allows a much wider audience for what you're talking about. It provides an opportunity to meet people of different languages and cultures. The only thing I would say is that if you're looking for an award like the DX Century Club, I don't think any of those links should go over the internet. All of those links should be RF, originating with a single transmitter going to a single receiver, or at least for each communication. And for that, I'm referring to things like remote ham radio, where you're remotely controlling your rig or someone else's rig, or they've established a mile or a radius of where an award can be given
You must have all of your transmitters within 50 feet or 50 miles or whatever the number is. I'm not completely sure of that. So anyhow, that's my two cents. AC2GS, WB2KW3.
Okay, that's a good point. I'll play devil's advocate, just to kind of make it the worst case scenario. I will give you a situation where even I felt the urge to be a gatekeeper. I bumped into a very nice gentleman. He has an extra license. He lives in a co-op apartment complex. Apparently, they give him a real tough time with any concepts of antennas. So what he has decided to do, and I think he's been doing it for almost 10 years now, is he pays a service on the Internet that offers voice over Internet protocol to other people on the Internet, so there's no RF, yet they give you a choice of injecting QRM Mary and QRN Nancy into the voice over Internet protocol so that it is more of lifelike on the HF band, and that is how he plays radio. Now, I'm willing to bet that there's a larger percentage of people with their clipboards out saying that's really not amateur radio. But I just thought I would throw it out as a devil's advocate sort of thing.
W2BZ?
Yes, Rich.
I've been a ham since 1961, and I get more of a sense of satisfaction out of talking to somebody in Georgia on an inverted Z that I cut myself and put up myself than I do talking to somebody in Australia on DMR. Even if you buy yourself an ICOM 7300 and then have an antenna company put up a tower and a beam for you, there is still some skill in operating HF, whether it's a pile-up skill or it's when to break into a QSO or whatever. There's a skill involved, and there's also, as you were saying, more the noise involved, the QRM and QSB and QRN. There's just so much more to it than buying a little hot box and a DMR radio and talking to somebody in Italy. I don't get any sense of satisfaction out of that. Not that other people don't. A lot of people do. But for me, I don't get a sense of satisfaction of talking to somebody over the Internet to Italy, because I talk to my daughter in Israel every other night over the Internet, and it's effortless. DMR is the same thing. HF and point-to-point communication, even what I'm doing now with, hitting the Sheldon repeater, is a whole other thing in my thinking. But to each its own. Back to you, Roy.
W2HU.
Yes, W2HU.
W2HL, Happy New Year, everybody. I agree with you, Richie. BZ. Roy, can I introduce a new topic?
Well, we haven't really gone through this one. If you want, I can put you on the list. I'm sure Wesley will kind of slide over for you, so you would be the next person, but we haven't really chewed this one up completely, I think.
Okay, so would I be next, or what's the queue?
Yeah, you'll be next.
No problem.
Okay, very good, Howard. Getting back to what you were saying, again, it depends on the individual. Rich is kind of saying is the challenge of it all. You know, what's the point if you're hunting for wild animals, and the guy brings the wild animal in front of you, chains it down, point the gun at the right place, and all you have to do is squeeze the trigger. You know, it's not much of an accomplishment. But again, it depends what you're trying to get out of it. If you're trying to get communications out of it, you know, Friday night, as I mentioned, tonight, Jeff isn't with us on Echolink, but Jeff, AB26MZ, does a Papa Network antenna technology net over on the West Coast. And if not for the hotspots and such, I would not be able to pick up his signal from California. So in that way, it's an aspect of communications as opposed to the challenge of communications. Although sometimes those hotspots don't work quite right, and